One of the things that I find absolutely remarkable about psychedelic medicines is the access one can have into discovering different parts of oneself, different ways in which we're put together, and also to see how we shape our worlds in a very interesting way experientially. And that has been shocking to me, even to see and experience how, you know, our psychological frameworks have a coherence and also feel structural in a way that, you know, when you can experience anxiety being removed and it coming back in and being held somewhere in your body in a very distinct way, or even to be able to travel into an anxiety held in the body in a distinct way and understand its roots and origins as if it was a structure in and of itself, has just been completely, to say it's been mind-blowing would be an understatement.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and today I'll be having the third in a series of conversations on the role that psychedelic medicines are beginning to play, deepening our understanding of how the mind works, and also demonstrating how they can play a very useful role in ameliorating otherwise disabling symptoms. The two prior interviews are on a sister podcast to this one, and the links are included in the show notes. The first was with Dr. Jeffrey Guss, who is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, and we just discuss his work on both the research side and the clinical side of using various psychedelic medicines for the relief of pain and suffering. And the second episode is with Dr. Ingmar Gorman, who is a psychologist and also a researcher and clinician in the world of psychedelic medicine, and most recently, one of the principal investigators, documenting the powerful ability of MDMA to soften, indeed relieve almost entirely, symptoms from severe and otherwise intractable post-traumatic stress disorder. Very important research. It's an FDA-sponsored trial and will have dramatic implications going forward. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Geeta Vaid, who approaches this world of psychedelics from a different vantage point. It isn't so much in the treatment of various syndromes. It's to assist a deepening of psychotherapy. And she makes very clear, and we have this conversation, about how she brings her psychoanalytic training to bear on how she's able to engage patients. And we have a conversation about the differing therapeutic mode of action of each of the treatment modalities. I found it illuminating and very promising for a future of some kind of integration between the two. Dr. Vaid is a board-certified psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, practicing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in New York City. She is a co-founder of the Center for Natural Intelligence, which is a multidisciplinary laboratory dedicated to psychedelic psychotherapy. She completed her residency training at NYU Medical Center and her psychoanalytic training at the Psychoanalytic Association of New York. She trained as a fellow in clinical pharmacology and neuropsychophysiology at New York Medical College and completed a research fellowship at NYU Medical Center. She serves as the director of psychedelic awareness at the Schoper Foundation and is on the faculty at the Ketamine Training Center. It's likely that people like myself have certain preordained notions of what psychedelics are and aren't, how they may be useful or dangerous. And I think it's likely that after you hear Dr. Vaid, you will have a different set of impressions and images about it. I know I certainly did. And I hope you find this as illuminating as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Gita Vaid. Gita, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Gita, the research findings that are emerging from clinical studies about psychedelics have been dramatic. And perhaps instead of calling them psychedelics, we should better call them psychedelic medicines, because they are really proving themselves to be powerful medicines, again, when properly utilized and when they're of good quality. They're not like street drugs, but these really do function as medicines in powerful ways. And the research findings, as you know, have been demonstrating usefulness for a host of conditions, for PTSD, for intractable depression, for OCD, for addictions. There's research going on with end-of-life issues, for eating disorders even, and even some research for Alzheimer's disease. So we are just at the beginning of a revolution in understanding how the mind works, but even further, intervening in new and creative ways. But our conversation today is a bit different, because your focus is on ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, and you bring a wonderful set of skills to address that. You are a trained and having been a practicing psychoanalyst. You're also a trained and a trainer of psychedelic clinicians. So you really have devoted yourself to an in-depth immersion in both mindsets. And that has led you to the practice that you now have, which is using ketamine to assist psychotherapy. And we're going to talk about your psychoanalytic journey, and we're going to talk about clinical cases that will demonstrate various points. But before we do, tell us about ketamine. It has a long history. It's used around the world. It's a safe medicine when properly used. But it's revealing this new ability to assist in depth self-awareness. But start us off.
Well, I'd love to talk to you about ketamine. Ketamine is a really interesting medicine. It's been around quite a long time. And I would say right now, in this excited wave of new treatment options involving psychedelics, ketamine has received tremendous attention because currently it is the only psychedelic medicine that is FDA approved and available and legal for use. So that's one of the reasons why it's received a lot of attention in this current movement. But it's actually been around a long time. It was developed in the 1950s by Parker Davis as an anesthetic to replace PCP, which was an anesthetic that caused a lot of emergence delirium phenomena. So they pretty much developed a shorter acting agent, which wound up being ketamine. And it had a lot of unusual properties that were quite useful in the 60s for treatment with anesthesia, because it really is short acting, doesn't affect the cardiovascular system, doesn't affect the respiratory system, and you can extend uses of it with repeat administration. So it's been used, you know, very well as an anesthetic. It's also been shown to have a lot of a usefulness in treatment of pain syndromes and has been very, very safe. So even children have been treated in emergency rooms for decades now with ketamine very safely. So there's a lot of safety data
And children do particularly well with it, yes?
Children do very well with it. And some of the emergent phenomena, which happens, you know, following ketamine, pretty soon got recognized as, you know, containing these mind-altering properties, which a lot of people interested in different states of consciousness immediately jumped on to try and investigate and learn more about. But ketamine actually didn't come into attention as an antidepressant until 2000s at Yale, where it was, you know, by serendipity, found to be a very unusual medicine because in addition to anesthesia, it was shown to have very, very rapid acting antidepressant properties. So that was huge because to have a new antidepressant that works so quickly for acute suicidality is completely unique in psychiatry. And there hasn't been such a development from a pharmacological basis of a whole different mechanism of action in treatment, you know, for depression. So that's been very exciting. But I think the more interesting application that we're talking about today is not only using it for its pharmacological effects, which impact depression and anxiety, but also examining different states of consciousness, which inherently can be healing and also can be leveraged further to open up a deeper exploration, which really overlaps, I think, with a lot of the tenets of psychoanalysis.
I'm eager to get there, but just want to flesh it out a little bit. In terms of the medical aspects of it, are there side effects? Are there dangers? Effects on blood pressure, panic attacks? What does one have to be careful for when thinking of a ketamine?
Well, ketamine itself, it's actually a very safe medicine, but with any medicine, you can have side effects. You know, so you always do have to be alert to the fact that any medicine can provoke, you know, an allergic reaction or an adverse event. But generally speaking, ketamine is very safe. It can cause fluctuations in blood pressure. So you want to make sure that someone's blood pressure is stable or low. Its biggest side effect, I would say, is nausea. So you would want to make sure that someone does not go into a session with a lot of food in their stomach, or generally speaking, fasting is better. Sometimes you might need to pre-medicate with an anti-nausea substance if someone is particularly prone to having nausea, because that can undermine an experience. It does pose the risk of abuse. It does have an abuse potential. And in individuals who take it and abuse it, you can develop, you know, all sorts of complications, particularly involving kidney damage. So it's not, you know, it's not a medicine that you want to, you know, take lightly, as with all medicines, right. But generally speaking, it has a very favorable safety profile.
And in terms of routes of administration, I know it can be given IM and IV. Are there pros and cons to each approach?
There are. It can be used in actually many different routes of administration. It can be given orally in lozenges, intranasally. It's oftentimes administered intravenously as well as intramuscularly. I've actually even heard of it being used, you know, with suppositories. So, you know, you can have it enter into the body in many different ways, and ketamine is ketamine, but it does shift the, you know, the unfolding of the experience depending on the route of administration. Some are very rapidly onset, others have a slow kind of entry. So in some ways, that can be interesting to choreograph the experience you're looking for based on the route of the administration and the unfolding.
And do you have a preferred method of administration?
I would say I've worked a lot with it with the, you know, lozenges, the oral lozenges, but my preferred route is the intramuscular these days, simply because it allows for more careful titration. It's more exact.
I hear you. Well, let's go to what makes your contribution unique because of your analytic background. You have written important papers on this, and just to pick a couple of quotes out to introduce you and your analytic background, you wrote, "Psychedelic psychotherapy provides a notable, interesting, and useful integration of psychological and biological perspectives." And that sentence jumped out at me because, as you know, and just about everybody knows, that the field of mental health care is unfortunately divided into those who think biologically and those who think psychologically. And it is unusual to find someone who not only thinks in an integrated way, but has skill sets to intervene in an integrated way. And you're suggesting that this is a modality that integrates the two, which is very promising. But tell us about your analytic background and where you were when you discovered the usefulness of psychedelics and how you were introduced to it.
Absolutely. Just to comment on your earlier point, I think that, you know, what you mentioned or focused on in the paper, I think is a very unique aspect of psychedelic medicine, certainly of ketamine too. But I would say the fact that you can have a medicine that introduces a state of, you know, different modes of knowing, different ways of thinking, an interruption of our default kind of habits and conditioning of thinking, and affects both the underlying brain pathways to create more plasticity. It really leverages the brain in a really active, primed state for new learning and taking in information and opening critical pathways, which really sets the stage for a very accelerated psychotherapy experience in a very unique healing field. So this is the area that I'm incredibly excited about in this work, which I'm hoping we'll get into in a little bit more detail.
Yes, for sure.
But I'm happy to share with you how I got interested in the work. And it's kind of an interesting story because, you know, I have a background as a psychoanalyst. But previous to that, I did do a research fellowship as well as a fellowship in psychopharmacology. So I have always been interested in both the brain as well as in the mind. And I met a fellow in my office who was a patient that I saw incredibly infrequently, an older gentleman who was a patient of mine and was in therapy with a colleague. But I would meet with him maybe once a year to check in on a few of his as-needed medications for sleep, as-needed medications for anxiety. He wasn't taking any standard medications. And sitting with him in the room, I could not understand what was so different in the actual experience of him. Because as I was getting more information about the course of his life, any changes, nothing had actually changed that was identified. And so after I started fishing around, trying to figure out what was going on, he asked me, well, what's going on? And I said, well, I'm trying to understand exactly what I just said, why the experience of you is so different. And I can't identify from your history anything that's changed. And he was very curious. He said, what are you noticing? And I said, well, the experience of sitting with you is so unique because I feel like I can have a really strong emotional connection to you. You seem incredibly open. And I can't understand what could account for the change. Mm-hmm. I pretty much shared with him that experience. And he said, well, that's so interesting. Now that you've recognized it, I'll share with you. I'm working with an underground psychotherapist working with some of these psychedelic medicines. He was really intrigued by what was coming up culturally and being reported was a lot of the studies at that time looking at end-of-life anxiety and depression in cancer patients having very good outcomes with psilocybin. And so this kind of really intrigued this guy. He was in his 80s and he wasn't dealing with chronic illness, but he was dealing with existential issues and fears about end of life and decline. So it caught his attention and he found someone to work with, and apparently it had been radically helpful for him. And then he went on to add, it's also been incredibly helpful in his relationship with his partner of many years. So that's what really opened up my inquiry. And then a request on my behalf of, would you mind asking your facilitator if he would be open to conversation with me, recognizing that, you know, that person might wish to keep it confidential, the work they were doing. But as it turns out, the facilitator was very open, and it started a series of conversations and questions and discussions about how these medicines work and
like we're doing,
how they
right?
might be useful.
Yeah. My reaction to that story with that patient reminds me of what many of us have. At times we will have an experience where we will, just like you described, run into someone that we haven't seen in a long time, and there's something different about them. They feel more centered. They feel more present. They feel more relatable. And depending upon our relationship, we might ask them, how are you? What are you doing? You seem good. And then they will share with us that they're in an analysis or an intensive therapy, and it's really made a big difference in their life. And at least my own experience when that happens is twofold. One is to be very happy for the person, that their life is richer for them than it ever was. And also pleased for the profession, for the work that we do and devote ourselves from, that goodness is both in the individual and in the process that they've engaged with. And it's sort of a reaffirmation of the work that I've devoted my life to. And it's sort of a blind study because you have no reason to assume. You don't go in meeting the person, well, I wonder if their treatment helped them. And then you bring biases to that. You just see the result and then work backwards. And that's what you described. You saw the result and you worked backward and you discovered that way, which is a very honest way, the power of psychedelic interventions. And I could imagine that made a very powerful impression on you.
Absolutely. It made a very, very powerful impression and really caught my attention. I think also because as psychoanalysts, that is the place where we live, I think. We really are very attentive to the space between two people and the connections. And so it's very much the field we are, I think, immersed in.
Yeah. So you started your journey at that point. Can you help us what it was like? I mean, you had at this time, correct me if I'm wrong, a busy psychoanalytic practice in New York, where I presume, tell me otherwise, you were not using psychedelic medicines. And then you shifted over. How did that take place?
Well, to fill you in a little bit more, this one event, which I talk as the, you know, talk about and identify as the main hook, I think was one of the components in a in an ongoing context. I also did, to be fair, the stage was set because I did have a colleague I was working with a lot who is a psychoanalyst as well. And he was an older gentleman, and he and I would refer patients to each other. He had amazing groups that I would oftentimes send individuals to. And he talked to me a lot about his involvement with psychedelics. This is a fellow who, you know, would describe to me how in the 60s, when he was a young man, you could just write to Sandoz and get a vial of LSD. Yeah. And in his early career, he had been working with the psychiatrist, the Canadian psychiatrist, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, looking at the early LSD research with alcoholism. And Humphrey Osmond is the person who actually coined the term psychedelic. So I'd heard these stories from my colleague about these extraordinary results and his own experiences as a young man with his colleagues and friends. So I was already very intrigued. And to be honest, I had also reached out to the NYU psychedelic department to talk to them about the work they were doing with the end-of-life studies with anxiety and depression. Steve Ross's group were looking at psilocybin. And so I'm part of NYU. So I had a conversation with them and they had invited me to be involved if I wanted to. So I was already kind of interested, engaged in this unfolding and very curious. And personally, I had not really tried these medicines, but I was very interested, I think, because there was an intuitive recognition of, you know, some of the components that I already was very well versed with through my psychoanalytic training. So there was a recognition, I think, that, you know, some of the ideas of deep regressive experience, accessing different aspects of our past, how they're held in the body and mind. I already was alert to these pieces. And I think this experience of this fellow in my office just gave me a more direct path to access an individual who was very knowledgeable about working with them. And I was just so delighted to have someone who could share with me how they used it in their clinical practice. As it turns out, this underground facilitator was also a psychoanalyst from the Reichian school, much more with bioenergetics. So it just led to a very rich conversation.
You walk us up to the central question, which is for those who have had intensive, call it regressive, intensive therapeutic analytic experiences on the couch for themselves, about how that is similar to and perhaps different from the intensive regressive experiences that one gets when it's psychedelically augmented. And you're a good person to help us understand that.
I think there's a lot of overlap and a lot of similarities, and I think also a lot of differences. So I think it's really both of those kind of pieces. And I do think my background and training and lens from psychoanalytic training served me well to really just be curious and, for my own gratification, interested in figuring out what's different. I felt like all of the forces are there. Some of them are amplified, but the rules all change in terms of how to work within that field. So it's been really interesting. And I would say the other piece of it is a lot of the field shifts and a lot of the way in which information is accessed is colored by the psychedelic medicine where you're using. You know, I'm also a MAPS-trained psychotherapist, so I have been part of the brilliant work done by MAPS looking at MDMA psychotherapy for PTSD. And MDMA is a very different medicine and creates a very different field compared to ketamine. So that also has a huge influence on what opens up.
The way you wrote about it is you make a reference to something called self-sculpture, which I'm going to ask you to explain in a minute, but you use it in this sentence, similar to psychoanalysis, where the removal of obstacles towards free association provides both the methodology and healing process, experiential awareness of the self-sculpture allows for acquisition of knowledge and correction simultaneously. Various self-components that have become exaggerated are softened, and this leads to correction of imbalanced protective systems. Help us with that.
Well, I would say one of the things that I find absolutely remarkable about psychedelic medicines is the access one can have into discovering different parts of oneself, different ways in which we're put together, and also to see how we shape our worlds in a very interesting way of experientially. And that has been shocking to me, even to see and experience how, you know, our psychological frameworks have a coherence and also feel structural in a way that, you know, when you can experience anxiety being removed and it coming back in a, and being held somewhere in your body in a very distinct way, or even to be able to travel into an anxiety held in the body in a distinct way and understand its roots and origins as if it was a structure in and of itself, has just been completely, to say it's been mind-blowing would be an understatement. It's such a unique access to oneself and how one is put together.
Let me ask you about that. This is in the category of a nudge. What you just described could fairly represent a meaningful analytic session where people become aware of their defensive structure. They become aware if things go well and there's a helpful space developed between in the dyad, that the analyst and patient together can become aware of what the history of that need for this obstacle is. The person can move into the obstacle and then move out of it, and also be aware of how the analyst and imagines the analyst, the transference analyst, in their mind playing a role in that process and regression. How do you see a difference between what you just described and what I just described? Or are they as similar as they sounded?
No, I would say, you know, your way of describing it is really helpful so I can distinguish what the differences are. I would say in a psychotherapy, even in a psychoanalytic psychotherapy where one is meeting with someone and engaged in a process of discovery, maybe once a week or twice a week, it does shift into being much more of a kind of interesting exploration and investigation, which is quite cognitive and putting two smart minds together to understand how the past has influenced the present moment. And maybe you can have some of those elements play out in the consulting room to see some of the drama between the therapist and the patient, you know, and join the dots of the past, infecting and using the, you know, the kind of, in a way, the clarity and the kind of privileged situation of the therapist and the patient to really discern those components.
In an affectively alive way.
In an alive way.
I'm nudging away from just the cognitive, which we know
Absolutely.
Isn't very useful.
And that's okay. much mm-hmm. more immersive in a psychoanalysis. If you
yes.
have someone on the couch 4 days a week, five
sure.
days a week, suddenly it moves it even further from the cognitive. It's mm-hmm. emotionally alive in a much more amplified way. And there's really a drama that unfolds, which is quite surprising to find oneself, as I have,
sure.
and I've experienced with others, engaged in a whole system of experience, which is very immersive and captures in a different way that gets shifted even further away from the cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that with the psychedelic medicines, it actually in record speed throws you into a different system where I think it's very alive. It's also more of a past-present amalgam. It's a different way of knowing, which is from different different places within one's capacity to know and discern, which some of which overlap, some of which are even deeper and different ways of, kind of more like dream states where you kind of understand information from dreams. I would say it's more like dreams that come up in psychoanalysis, which oftentimes we will know to value, mm-hmm. except for you're in the dream process itself during the session, where every moment is, you know, highly saturated with significance. And the analyst or the therapist is part of the dream furniture. So it's on a spectrum of being kind of related, but even more so.
Okay. Let me stay with this for just one more observation. Because I'm trying to feel, I have such high regard for the usefulness of these briefer and intense regressive experience. The data is clear that they're very useful, and I'm trying to set it next to what I know is useful from my own experiences clinically to try to see how they speak to each other. That one of the most powerful experiences for an analysand is to discover that what they have taken for normal, and let's say it's in the dyad, it's with their analyst, with the therapist, that the way they understood themselves in relation to the therapist and the therapist in relation to themselves, they suddenly at times come to an awareness that none of that is accurate. None of that is true. All of that has been living out a past template that they didn't know existed, which then allows a whole new set of opportunities to discover that the inhibitions that they felt that were based on this template from their past can fall away, and that they can experiment with new freedoms and new creativities and new ways of experiencing themselves and the therapist and their lovers and their friends, and all kinds of opportunities open up. But the key to that is in the dyad, is in the relationship with their therapist over a long period of time. My understanding of psychedelic-assisted therapy is that that is not what happens. That maybe something similar happens, but that isn't the vehicle for it through the transference awareness of the past living in the present.
I would say, actually, I think the transference is not necessarily the vehicle towards discovering that template. The medicine itself perhaps can allow someone in the most rapid way, a recognition of an awareness beyond self. Let's talk about ketamine for a moment. With ketamine, mm-hmm. one can have an experience of an awareness where they are not their mind, they are not their feelings, they're not their somatic, they're not even actually, and even to recognize from experience, to step back in and see how one's world is shaped, and to see in a way the lenses that inform that gives one, you know, in a very different way of recognition that, oh, I've constructed my world according to these templates mm-hmm. that were my early life. And then a chance to access those new possibilities that in a very different way. But I think the therapist's role actually might facilitate that experience, but the experience itself allows one's recognition of those templates. And I think the therapist and the transference actually can be used to leverage to open up new possibilities and open up new ways of relating in the here and now.
Hmm. And are there characteristic ways that you, as the therapist, the guider, facilitator, that you are experienced by the individuals going through this, or is it varied as individuals are varied?
I would say there are some character. I would say both. You know, of course, everyone is so unique and so different that it's hard to generalize. But I would say there are certain certain pieces. You know, I think it's such a intense experience, and I think there's so much trust that one is putting into one's hand as a you know, to be supported in this way. I think it amplifies the transference, and the potential for repair and correction and the real relationship is much more magnified. Of course, that happens in analysis, but I would say this is even more intense and more, perhaps more extreme.
And has the advantage of being briefer.
And very brief, yes.
How many treatments do most of the people you work with go through?
You know, I really don't work with it, generally speaking, as it's employed as an antidepressant. For antidepressant treatment, right, there's usually a sequence. I really try and I've moved into tailoring it for the individual because I really do it in the context of ongoing psychotherapies, either with myself or with a colleague. For me, it's more about having these deep accesses to oneself and listening to what the unfolding is from some of that knowledge and that enhancement of capacities. And so I will tailor it to the person. It might be that, you know, I would have introduced someone if they have a good experience and listening to the the downstream effects, I might invite them to repeat it after 4 to 6 weeks. I try and not, you know, I try and use it to open up and catalyze an unfolding process and then follow the direction of the unfolding process and use that as the guide rather than some algorithm.
I understand. You know, I'm imagining just as when you're working with a patient in intensive therapy and you have the thought that perhaps medicine of the more traditional sort, an SSRI, let's say, might be useful for them at this point, it's reasonable to pause and examine yourself, like what's in me that might be contributing to this thought that perhaps it would be helpful. Not that it's only derived from countertransference, but one wants to be careful that one isn't prescribing something because of one's own needs. That's a difficulty tolerating depressive affect, for example, is a commonplace one. I'm imagining something similar, that when you're working with an individual and you have this thought that perhaps a ketamine session would be useful, what goes through your mind that leads you to think that leads you to conclude, yes, it is a good idea, or no, it's coming from someplace in me? How does your mind work at those moments?
Well, I feel like I have so much now knowledge and understanding and compared to when I first started working with medicines, of how to work with it. It's actually almost like a different psychotherapy, even if it's informed. I mean, I would really say it's a different kind of system of operating under. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm using it as a tool in the toolbox of psychotherapy. It's more of a different set of frameworks of thinking about psychotherapy in some ways. So I would say someone who might reach out to me, you know, oftentimes is seeking out this kind of work, or even someone I'm working with in psychotherapy. I mean, I'll give you a recent example. You know, it occurred to me when this fellow who I've worked with for a very long time and actually has made good progress in psychotherapy, you know, I feel like he's spinning his wheels, even though he understands where this is coming from and we've done a lot of work and he understands the patterns and he's still kind of...
The affective part is missing, right? The missing affective part, yeah.
Even if he's effective and engaged with me, but can't break out of these patterns that are all too known to him and is frustrated and stuck and recognizes in the fullest way over, you know, a successful treatment of where it comes from, but still can't find different ways of liberating himself from some of those positions that aren't really working.
And what happens?
I would say that, you know, for me, I don't really think there are tremendous shortcuts, generally speaking. Of course, one can have a big epiphany, but really most of our solutions as psychoanalysts, we know most of our stuck places are compromises and are, you know, based on solutions to underlying difficulties. So there is this kind of system of emotional regulation and ways of coping our deficits beneath in all of these underlying systems. I think the medicines really open up not only different ways of thinking and new solutions and shifts in defensive structures, but probably more importantly, allow for repair work on deeper levels that have actually rendered most of us to some extent a little bit brittle or with some deficits required for coping. So I think the part that I value the most is you can actually get to some real foundational repairs, you know, areas that psychoanalysts might think of pre-Oedipal level kind of concerns, right. Which oftentimes we have a really hard time thinking about or addressing, even though I think we all recognize it's, you know, as you said, this effective kind of dyadic exchange, this emotional experience of being with another person. That's a very rich, if not the richest way, we can influence another person and create safety and build new possibilities for an individual.
Can you describe a clinical situation where it turned out to be useful in the way you're describing?
I can. I have a clinical vignette I'd love to share with you because I think it captures and perhaps illustrates a little bit of what I'm trying to communicate, which is oftentimes hard to understand because it's so abstract. I'm going to describe perhaps a clinical vignette of a young woman that I worked with. I'm going to call her V. She's a 33-year-old, attractive woman who was referred to me by her boyfriend, who himself had benefited from work with ketamine. And V, when she met me, I was very struck that she was a very beautiful, petite, blonde woman and had a fragile, girl-like physique, was very quiet and pensive, with an intense gaze. She was clear and strong and intelligent in her thinking and manner, which really contrasted with her waif-like, almost vanishing ethereal presence. She was actually terrified about taking ketamine with me and was really fearful about being in an altered state. But she recognized that was because she really oriented herself and place in the world through understanding and thinking, so was a bit freaked out at the idea of being out of control. But she was also really intrigued by the treatment and the meditative effects, and so she wanted to pursue it. So after just, I think, a couple of sessions talking about her life and her history and her readiness, we went ahead and did a ketamine session with 100 milligram oral lozenge. And during that experience, she actually had a very long experience. She was amazed by the beauty, the colors, the shapes, and the visuals. And she happily navigated through the experience playing, researching the effects of ketamine, and was quite delighted by the session. In fact, earlier in her life and career, she'd been a researcher with a PhD in neuroscience, so she was quite intrigued. And after the session, she was quite tired and took a long time coming back to herself and reconstituting. I later found out that night she'd been very cranky and irritable towards her boyfriend. She described feeling overly rejected by him and neglected by him because he decided to go ahead and eat dinner before her. And we talked about how it was true that he didn't wait for her, but she was also really aware she has this trigger and sensitivity about rejection and it has nothing to do with the boyfriend, but that was activated. After that session, we agreed to do a second session a few weeks later. And this was really interesting because talking about the transference, the reason I had done the oral session was because she had a needle phobia. And because of the trust that was established and her actually feeling safe in the experience and quite enjoying it, minus the crankiness afterwards, which she attributed to this rejection sensitivity, she actually felt safe enough to try the intramuscular, which I had explained to her what the differences were. She decided to actually agree to do it, even though she was fearful. And with the second dose, with 15 milligrams, which is about the same dose, but more a different kind of unfolding, she plunged into a deep space with me, became young and fearful before my eyes. She collapsed into a childlike little girl, asking for me and then giggling with pleasure and delight to discover I hadn't left her and was close by attending to her. And there was a sequence of a back and forth of her losing the connection to me, becoming very fearful, hesitantly asking if I was still there, and upon hearing my voice, expressed sheer delight at rediscovering my attention and presence. Now, it's noteworthy she lost connection to me, in spite of my being really present to her, attentive, sitting very close to her. I also was stroking her arm, and at times even stroking her hair to actively soothe and reassure her that I hadn't left her and I was attending to her. During the session, she asked me if I was a mother and was so happy to hear this. She actually knew this about me, but seemed to be asking it more to pronounce it and celebrate it. At times, She was calling me an angel. Upon rediscovering yet again, I was indeed near her and hadn't left her. At times, she was literally singing my name with deep appreciation and joyful gratitude. For periods, she felt like she was in my lap. She wasn't, but she became so young and very, caught up in this very young state. I had that experience of almost feeling that. This seemed to be a narrative of loss and reconnection, a working through for abandonment and unity. After the session, she was a bit confused and exhausted, felt it had been a very deep experience, but wasn't really quite sure what happened. She knew she needed a lot of hugs and care, so she was very happy that a girlfriend was picking her up. Interestingly, again, she was quite dismissive of her boyfriend and really, you know, was very clear she needed a woman, kind of focus to soothe her and care for her. So that's a little bit about the session details, which might give you a sense of what a strange space we're operating in. And I think you can see from that how a lot of the rules of psychoanalysis and a lot of my behavior are not acting in accordance with psychoanalytic principles.
Well, they are in the sense that you're meeting the patient where they are.
Absolutely. Yeah, but if I can take a few more minutes, I'd like to describe what happened when she came in for her integration sessions.
We're eager to hear what happens, sure.
So during the week, she came and had the integration session, and she said to me she had a profound experience. And the downstream effects were absolutely extraordinary. She then described what she termed was a big breakthrough. She felt she suddenly had become clear about something that she had been muddled and stuck in for a long time. And this was not something she'd actually even brought into the preliminary sessions. She described a complex situation with a pair of friends, a couple she had worked with fairly recently and become immediately close friends with. And she reported being very stressed, muddled, and confused because they weren't working out in her business and she couldn't figure out why. She said she'd never had a problem like this in business before. They kept receiving complaints all the time, but the couple were confident and clear the blame lay on other parties and kept obscuring the issues in a manner that rendered V very disorganized and confused. People were coming to her, asking for support or complaining, and she couldn't figure out what was going on. However, immediately following the session, she was able to see the truth and somehow emerge from this confused muddle. She immediately confronted the couple and was stunned when they responded with unprofessional attacks. She saw immediately that these are deceptive and manipulative cons who are neglecting responsibilities, covering up incompetence and inadequacies. And she took action immediately and she fired them and immediately made amends with her clients. And as an aside, when she spoke to me, she didn't look like this waif anymore and this kind of fragile girl. She looked straighter, confident, and powerful in her presentation as well as in her thinking. She then went on to reveal to me that this had actually happened many times before. An ex-boss who had sexually harassed her was extremely abusive, an ex-boyfriend who was actually really creepy and strange and even implicated in a murder, a former business partner at work who had stolen money. The characters and context changed, but the essential theme was the same. She would get confused and unable to see toxic situations where she was treated abusively and taken advantage of and would have a difficult time recognizing them and even a harder time extricating herself. So I made some comments about interpreted how she seemed to be blurring and disguising some of that incompetence. And I wondered where this pattern had come from in her life. And she went into a whole formulation, understanding where it came from her neglectful mother and her rage attacks and inconsistencies and a lot of the kind of background stuff. But I think the more important stuff was the session had allowed her to become really aware of all of this in a very different way. And this defense of obscuring, the truth and all of this information seemed to have evaporated in record speed. And she was able to break out of this sort of set of operating principles. It was really quite remarkable.
And to go back to what we were saying before, what's remarkable also to me is that this transformation in her took place without her working it through between the two of you. That is, ordinarily in a treatment, one might anticipate that she would see you as incompetent, or she would present herself as incompetent to you, that incompetent valence would live between the two of you, and unpacking it and its history would give her the freedom that you're describing she now had without going that route.
Yes, I would say in this example, of course, everyone is different. It felt like instead of being kind of tangled up in the defenses and the whole kind of, you know, in a certain sense, the final common pathways of experience, which is what we typically do mm-hmm. as analysts, it had actually had an effect on a deeper level of some of the underpinnings of that, which was some of the kind of underlying attachment issues that seemed to be the area of exchange between us in the sessions. I think she'd actually, in retrospect, had a bit of that transference going into it. But there was something about my willingness to enter into this in that way, respond to her at that level. And then even actually subsequently, after this great piece of work, she said she would like to actually decide when she came back herself. And she did. I'd known of a treatment with a very problematic treatment with an analyst that she'd been in previously, where she had doubted herself because of her fuzziness in her thinking and would be kind of always deferring to him. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was mm-hmm. fairly problematic treatment because I think out of, you know, misunderstanding the situation had kind of become quite paternal towards her in a way that was in and of itself had its own set of problems mm-hmm, instead right of her so. Being able to step into her power. So of her also deciding, you know, this was really big for her. She'd done a lot of work. She wanted to really absorb it. And could she keep in touch with me? And so she did that. She actually came back several months later and said it had been sustained. Now she was ready to go a bit deeper. But I think even part of the experience of owning and really herself having agency over herself and trusting herself was a big aspect. So it feels very developmental, actually, some of the pieces of this kind of work. Mm-hmm.
And the boyfriend that encouraged her to do it, with whom she struggled, did that take on new dimensions?
Actually, they have made tremendous progress in their relationship. Uh-huh. They're actually expecting a child right now, so they're uh-huh. in a very good place. So that has yeah. actually improved, and some of the difficulties which came up have actually been worked through. And she's progressing in her life in beautiful ways. She's always been a very bright woman and successful in business, but I think this is a much more balanced kind of appreciation of relationship, family, and work.
What a lovely vignette. Let me ask you about some of the people you treat, obviously anonymously, but you treat people in the field, in the analytic field, in the mental health world. And I wonder, A, if it's different working with them, and even beyond that, do you hear back from them what the experiences that their patients have? I'm thinking of a common situation where a therapist will be stuck in some kind of impasse with a patient, and the therapist will pursue a consultation. The consultant will point out what they point out, and then the therapist returns to the office with that patient, and before the therapist says anything, the patient will say, "You're different. Something's changed." And there was something by, in making contact with the consultant, the supervisor, in and of itself changed the stuck rhythm that they were in. So I'm taking that model and imagining what it would be like for perhaps some of the people you work with who undergo this treatment and then go back and see their clients and patients. Walk us through what this has been like for you.
I think it's really interesting because it is such a uniquely intimate space one has as a psychotherapist with one's patients. But I would say it invariably does influence one's own connection to oneself, one's openness to oneself, and one's corresponding openness to another person. And I think it does, a lot of people have remarked on how much it shifts their way of working mm-hmm. in subtle ways and indirect ways. I think there's more of a presence, more of a emotional availability. I think there's much more of a capacity to be in the present moment and real, and perhaps more, more revealed and more able to enter into a full engagement, which I think we all recognize is probably the most central aspect anyway, is the real relationship in the moment with the person. But instead of that being in the background, that perhaps that gets to be entered into more fully.
Now, I understand you, and help me with this, because self-revelation is, of course, a talked about issue. And my understanding of it is there's self-revelation done for narcissistic purposes, where someone wants or needs an audience to admire or something. And then there's self-revelation done in service of the other, that is to address something that's happening in the treatment that the patient is struggling with. And you think if you reveal something about yourself, it might introduce something useful that the patient can then move on. And I'm imagining you're not referring to the narcissistic version of self-revelation.
I'm not even referring to revelation. I'm talking about being more available and fully present in a different way.
Ah, okay.
Which might involve revealing, yeah. But oftentimes I think it isn't. I think it's more of just being really fully engaged, more fully available, more present, more in the room with the person, more there as a real person and present, and not retreating from full availability and full engagement.
That immediacy.
The immediacy. Right, I think there's sort of the space between... I think there's sort of a sense of fuller engagement within oneself. I do think there's a corresponding, as there is more of this kind of connection to oneself and in a building of inner integrity that translates to improved connections within ourselves as well as within others. So I think it just opens up more access, which doesn't have to be a revelation as much as about presence.
Gita, there was a symposium that took place here in Philadelphia in 1968 on the use of psychedelics in clinical care. And the organizers of this symposium were three psychoanalysts in Philadelphia. And there's a book out on it. And it turns out that those three psychoanalysts later became very important teachers of mine in my own psychoanalytic education, though they never mentioned their past history and interest in this. But you and others are picking the ball up, and yes, the research on all the syndromes is vital and will be life-changing for many people, but what you're doing is also vital and life-changing in a different way, and I'm so delighted to know of your work and to read about it and to discuss it with you and to share it with our listeners, because there really is to be an interface and should have an interface between an analytic way of thinking and, dare say, a psychedelic way of thinking. I'm not sure. Maybe self-sculpture is a good way to describe it. But I am eager to hear more about your work as it deepens. The field is obviously growing enormously. And thank you for educating me and for sharing your thoughts with me and our listeners. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Harvey. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. I so appreciate you having me on your podcast.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.